So my title is at least partially inspired by the approach of my favorite non-holiday of the year in a week. I'm talking about some work with Sun-Chia Cheng, Shinji Mokoyama, and Paolo Caminelli, who are postdocs at Harvard, and Marcus Ludi and Matthias Zaldarriaga. And so the second part is really less tongue-in-cheek. I want to talk about a consistent infrared deformation of general relativity. The motivation for doing this is that while, especially here, it's famously known that gravity does strange things in the ultraviolet, theoretically. Experimentally, every large distance probe of gravity at larger distances has revealed bizarre phenomena. From the flattening of galactic rotation curves to the dimming of supernova in the accelerating universe. And our usual explanation for these things is to invoke new forms of matter, and energy, dark energy, to explain at least those two phenomena. And so it's fair to say that we're truly in the dark ages of cosmology. I think it's worth remembering this is not the first time this happened. 150 years ago, very clever astronomers measured and discovered that Mercury was doing something strange. There was the precession of the perihelion of Mercury. And these smart people back then knew, well, okay, there's something going on. Similar weird things for the further out planets predicted Neptune and Pluto. So there's similar weird stuff going on at short distances. Obviously, what we have to do is invoke dark planet. And in fact, there was a dark planet, Vulcan, that was invented, a little closer than Mercury to the sun going around. And you know, it didn't quite work in detail, but anyway, in the end of the day, we know the answer wasn't dark planet, it was gravity is wrong. Change gravity. Newton to GR. So, of course, since history almost never repeats itself in physics, you could use this as a justification that, in fact, dark matter and dark energy are right. Okay, and this time, it's just this boring explanation. But I think it's worth thinking about, and it's an interesting sort of theoretical frontier to try to see if it's possible to hammer away at gravity in the infrared in order to at least try to address some of these mysteries. And the first step is to just try to make a consistent theory, something that's theoretically consistent and experimentally viable, that does modify gravity in the infrared in some way. Then we can see if it starts doing any of these interesting things. And there have been a number of sorts of proposals. To my mind, the best ones are these sorts of theories. For example, massive gravity goes back to Fiertz and Pauli in 1939. They take the Einstein action and they add a mass term. It has to have a very special form. But anyway, so if you add such a term, you get a graviton mass of that size. And more recently, there have been these extremely interesting models, the Dvalli-Ghabardadze-Porati models of gravity in infinite volume extra dimensions, where there's a three brain with a large induced four-dimensional Ricci term on it compared to the bulk Planck scale. And if you look just roughly at what the potential looks like on the brain, it looks four-dimensional at short distances and five-dimensional at long distances. And of course, there are other sorts of proposals. I'd say that almost all the other sorts of proposals are in one way or another, either explicitly or in disguise, scalar tensor theories of gravity. And so those aren't interesting to me. They don't really modify gravity. They're just adding scalars. Okay. These really modify gravity. There's something physical going on here. Gravity does really weird things at very large distances in these theories. Okay, either it dies off exponentially or it becomes five-dimensional. But of course, and you might naively think this is a bad theory because it breaks general coordinate invariance. This is a good theory because it's geometrical. But of course, we all know that general covariance is not a symmetry. It's a fake. It's a redundancy of description. And so, in fact, there's no issue about whether something is generally coordinate invariant or not. The issue is, what are the physical degrees of freedom that are propagating in the theory, and how do they interact? And the problem, it turns out, there's sort of a beautiful story for both of these models, which actually end up being nearly identical to each other, that in both of these cases, there's a problem, which is that matter is coupled with gravitational strength to new degrees of freedom, in particular to a scalar degree of freedom, pi, and the scalar degree of freedom becomes strongly coupled, and the effective theory for it breaks down at very large distances. It breaks down at a scale lambda 3 given by m graviton squared m Planck to the minus a third, or 1 over the crossover scale m Planck to the minus a third. And if we put these scales to be around Hubble, that distance scale ends up being around 1,000 kilometers. So there's a sort of beautiful story here. I don't have time to go into it. But the difficulty is that you've tried to modify gravity in the infrared at the Hubble scale, and there's wham, an associated modification in the ultraviolet at and where the ultraviolet is 1,000 kilometers. Okay? So the fact that modifying things in the IR gives rise to modifications in the UV is not some magic UV-IR thing that has to do with gravity. The same thing happens for massive gauge bosons. But the situation is actually both qualitatively and quantitatively worse in the case of gravity. Let me just tell you what this mode is in these two theories. In the case of massive gravity, it's just the scalar longitudinal mode of the graviton. In the case of the DGP model, it's the brain bending mode of the parametrizing the location of the three brain. But so there's a pretty story, but let me tell you the punchline for this story. Okay? The punchline is that this happens because you can think of these theories as coupling gravity to a sector that's sick in the limit as gravity is decoupled. Okay? So in particular, if you turn off gravity, these pi's have no kinetic term. They have interactions, but they have no kinetic term. They, in fact, only acquire a kinetic term because of mixing with gravity. And that's the sort of heart of the problem. This is not what happens in gauge theory. If you have a massive gauge boson and you turn off the gauge coupling, you're just left with the Goldstone bosons, which are a healthy theory. That's not what happens here. So I think the status up to now is that there is not a consistent, both theoretically and experimentally viable, consistent modification of gravity in the IR. That's what I want to tell you about in this talk. So it is possible to do this. It is possible to couple gravity to a sector, which is healthy all by itself. Of course, I can just couple gravity to a scalar. That's not so interesting. Here, you can think about it as coupling gravity to a scalar, but it's a very interesting scalar. And it's possible to modify gravity in the IR in a way that avoids these problems. And ghost condensation is a language in which you can choose to describe it, although as a good effective field theorist, I hate to do it. I don't have to describe it this way, but in describing this to colleagues, I somehow find that many of them understand it this way more easily. You'll see why. But the claim is that it's at least in all of our investigations so far, seems to be a fully controllable, calculable IR modification of gravity. And the interesting thing is now when you have something that's a consistent IR modification of gravity, as you'll see, what it does is really bizarre in the infrared. And very interesting. So since just some of the phenomena that we're going to see are a little unusual, I just want to first start telling you the sorts of things we're going to see, and then I'm going to try to come back and explain why they happen. So this ghost condensate is a new kind of fluid that can fill the universe. It's a new kind of cosmological fluid. It has P equals minus rho, identically to a cosmological constant. Its energy momentum tensor is identical to that of a cosmological constant, but it is not a cosmological constant. It's a physical fluid with a physical excitation. Okay? You can think about it, well, not even so loosely, as a theory where you have a scalar field, the normal theory where you have a scalar field, but the scalar field gets a time-dependent VEV. Okay? In particular, it gets a VEV where the magnitude of its velocity is constant. Okay? Phi dot is equal to constant. I can expand phi around that background as phi is the magnitude of phi plus pi. This pi is an excitation around the background. Okay. A way that you can think that this would happen, because normal scalars don't do this. If I have a massless scalar field, it's true that there are solutions where it has some velocity, but what happens is that velocity redshifts to zero as the universe expands. Okay. Normal scalars don't do this, but you can think of this as arising from ghost condensation. Okay? And let me just very briefly say, suppose you have a theory where you have a scalar that starts off with the wrong sign kinetic term, Now, normally we say this theory is bad because it's not unitary. That's garbage. It has nothing to do with unitarity. It has to do with a physical instability. It has to do with the fact that that the energy densities are unbounded below in this sector. In fact, if it didn't couple to any other sector, I could just redefine the Lagrangian by an overall minus sign and everything would be totally fine. The difficulty is that when you have two sectors, one with right sign and one with wrong sign kinetic terms, there's just a violent vacuum instability. So the problem is instability, not formal issues. But you can ask, in analogy with what happens with tachyons, is there any way we can talk about condensing ghosts? So imagine that there are some higher derivative terms or something. I'm just writing a very general Lagrangian here. The only thing I'm assuming is that there's a shift symmetry acting on the field, so it only appears derivatively in the Lagrangian. So is it possible that sort of an analogy with tachyons, you can stabilize, expand around a background where now the derivative of phi is not equal to zero, and expand around that background, look at the fluctuations, and the fluctuations are all healthy. Now, naively, you would think that since these are all higher dimension operators, that this whole picture cannot possibly make sense in a consistent effective field theory. That's wrong. There's actually fully controllable derivative expansion for the low energy effective theory. It's in fact a very interesting effective theory, and I'll write it down. But put that reservation aside for a second. I'm now just going to tell you some of the properties of this ghost condensate, some of the properties of these fluctuations. And they have two very important physical properties that in combination lead to a host of very interesting physical phenomena. So here are two properties. One of them is that the symmetries of the theory, actually in concert with Hubble friction, as you'll see, guaranteed that we are driven to a point which can be described at low energies by an effective Lagrangian that at quadratic level has now normal sign kinetic terms for all these fields. There's a pi dot squared, but there is no conventional grad pi squared kinetic term. Okay? So the first spatial kinetic term is actually of order grad to the fourth. That means that these fields have a low energy dispersion relation, which is omega squared is k to the fourth over m squared, not k squared. This fluid does not expand with a uniform speed. Small lumps expand fast, big lumps expand slow. Keep that in mind. Sorry? No, absolutely not. And well, we'll talk about it, but obviously the background has a non-zero time derivative. So you shouldn't be scared of this sort of, well, we'll talk about it. The second important property, and this has something to do with gravity now, is that in this theory, there are actually two kinds of energy, and both gravity and anti-gravity. So what's going on here? This background, phi equals ct, clearly breaks time translational invariance. Okay? However, there's also a shift symmetry in the theory, phi goes to phi plus constant. And in fact, the diagonal combination of these two is left as an unbroken shift symmetry, which is interpreted in the background as the time translational invariance. So an experimentalist who can't couple to gravity in this world would identify the conserved energy with that time translation. Okay, that's, let's call that the particle physics energy of pi. But that's not the energy that gravitates. The energy that gravitates is associated with the original time shift symmetry of the theory. Okay, so E particle physics is not E gravity. And in fact, E particle physics, just from the low energy Lagrangian I gave you before, looks like pi dot squared plus k to the fourth. However, it turns out that e-gravity begins at linear order in pi dot. Because this linear order in pi dot can have either sign. And so in this theory, there's both gravity and anti-gravity. If I make a lump of pi dot, and the lump has a positive pi dot, then it attracts test particles. If I have a lump of negative pi dot, it repels test particles. Okay. So these two things are going to combine to do interesting things. Okay, so let me tell you a little bit about what some physical consequences of this sector are. The standard model fields do not have to couple directly to this sector, other than through things that are mediated by gravity loops. Okay, so but they don't have to, but they could. So this is not model independent. But if they could, then the leading sort of coupling they would have is that a sort of familiar kind of axial vector coupling from Goldstone boson physics. In this case, though, if I stick in phi equals ct, the first thing I get is a tiny Lorentz violating mass term, which gives a minuscule particle-antiparticle splitting. But I also get a derivative coupling to these pi's. And I can exchange them, and they generate a spin-dependent long-range force. We're used to that from Goldstone bosons. But ordinarily, spin-dependent long-range forces are 1 over r to the fourth. Here, they're 1 over r squared. They're 1 over r squared because of the k to the fourth dispersion relation rather than the k squared dispersion relation. So it's a real fluid. If you couple to it, you get particle-antiparticle mass splittings. You get long-range inverse square law spin-dependent forces. Now, we don't have to couple to it directly, but gravity does. So let me tell you what happens to gravity in this background. Of course, something's going to happen in the infrared, but you should now expect, because the space and time scales are, the dispersion relation is funny, as omega squared is k to the fourth, space and time scales where modifications happen are actually uncorrelated. They're correlated, they're not the same. So things start getting modified at a distance of m Planck over m squared. M is the mass scale in this background. But it takes a much longer time of order m Planck squared over m cubed to see any of this happening. And what happens? In this theory, you can't just say, what does a static Newton potential look like? It's because normally when we look at static potentials, we ignore retardation effects, and that's okay because everything travels at the speed of light. Here, things don't travel at the speed of light. The pi is slowing down. So it's actually important to ask a physical question. And the physical question is, let's say you have a cloud of dust that collapses to make a planet, sort of quickly collapses to make a planet at some time t equals zero. What does the gravitational potential look like? And it looks like this. I'm plotting r v of r. So in Newtonian theory, it would be flat. And that's also what you get at times much less than this critical time, tc. Then at a time comparable to tc, it starts getting modified. And it gets modified by getting a wiggle. It's not like what you'd expect from a Yukawa potential, where things are dying off exponentially. Instead, you get a wiggle. If you wait a time of order 100 times, sorry, this is the critical time, then you see 100 wiggles. So deep in the future, instead of getting an e to the minus mr over r type Yukawa potential, you get a cos mr over r potential. There's an oscillatory modification of Newton's law. And the reason that happens has to do with the fact that the pis can both gravitate and anti-gravitate. When you make a collapsing cloud, it sets up a gravitational potential, and the pis start to oscillate in this potential. You give off a pi wave. In the pi wave, there's regions where pi is positive and regions where it's negative. In the regions where it's positive, it gravitates. In the regions where it's negative, it anti-gravitates. So what are some typical parameters here? If the scale is an inverse millimeter, then this is an example. Remember I told you this condensate has identical energy momentum tensor as a cosmological constant. So this is a case where this ghost condensate can actually give us our acceleration of the universe even if the formal cosmological constant vanishes. Okay. In this case, the length scale over which these gravitational modifications start happening is order the size of the universe, but the time scale is actually way longer than the age of the universe. Okay. So if we could only probe it gravitationally, we would actually have to wait an incredibly long time before we started seeing any of these effects gravitationally. If we are lucky enough to couple to it directly, we might be able to see minuscule particle-antiparticle mass splittings and long-range inverse square law spin-dependent forces, but we don't have to. So this m you can think of as the velocity of the scalar field. M squared is the velocity of this scalar field. What's the in the standard model sector? Yeah. It depends on the strength of the coupling. Okay, but the limits are like 10 to the minus 25 GeV, so it's got to be very small. But these scales are small, and so for example, those limits are easily satisfied if you couple this thing through 1 over m Planck or 1 over m Gott operators. Another interesting range of parameters is when this scale is of order 10 MeV. So if it's of order 10 MeV, this can actually be motivated because, as you'll see, we can also use this to drive inflation. But anyway, 10 MeV here was chosen to actually make the critical time scale where things start happening of order the age of the universe. The distance scale where they start happening is then 1,000 kilometers. So this is a theory where just recently in the history of the universe, gravity starts getting repulsive at 1,000 kilometers. But not at 2,000 kilometers or at 10,000 kilometers. It'll take 10 times the age of the universe for it to start getting wiggly at 10,000 kilometers. Now, all of this is the analog of the Higgs mechanism for gravity. Now remember, gravity is the gauging of translations. Okay? So when you have a background where phi is equal to t, that's spontaneously breaking translations. It breaks the time diffeomorphism symmetries. And so therefore, you should just naively expect that you get quote-unquote massive gravity. Now, of course, since this isn't a Lorentz invariant background, I'm not getting five polarizations of the graviton. Okay? In fact, I'm just getting one extra degree of freedom, which is obvious in this ghost condensate language. It's just the fluctuations of the background. Now, in gauge theory, when you have the spontaneous symmetry breaking, you get a positive mass squared, and we're familiar with Yukawa potentials. Here, I told you you get wiggly things instead of exponentially dying things. And that difference is actually what we're used to all the time as the difference between gravity and gauge theory. It's just that like charges attract for gravity and repel for electromagnetism. It's exactly the same thing that, for example, in a plasma gives you a positive plasmon mass for the photon, but gives you an effectively negative mass squared for the scalar, for the genes instability. Okay, it's the reason why there's a genes instability, but you get a positive mass, you get a positive plasmon mass. Okay? And so, in fact, you can sort of push this analogy. I mean, it's not an analogy. You can just now describe it just like in gauge theory. We can describe things in a unitary gauge as sort of directly a modification of the gauge theory. We can do that here too. There's a unitary gauge description of the physics where I just set pi equal to zero. It's just equivalent to choosing a coordinate system where phi is the clock. Okay? Phi is equal to t. This still leaves the freedom to make time-dependent spatial diffeomorphisms. But what we can now do is just write down all the terms that are allowed, which are not invariant under the full diffeomorphism symmetry of the theory, but are invariant under this residual symmetry. So I just make a 3 plus 1 split. And I write everything down that's just invariant under that, rather than full diffeomorphisms. For GR aficionados, in ADM language, when I normally make a 3 plus 1 split, I have 10 components of the metric. So here they are. There's G00, there's G0i, there's gamma ij. Naively, 10 degrees of freedom in the metric. But normally in GR, when you have full diffeomorphism invariants, N and Ni appear in the Lagrangian as Lagrange multipliers enforcing constraints, in the same way that A0 appears in E and M enforcing the Gauss-Law constraint. And so you're just left with the physical degrees of freedom and the gamma. They have time derivatives on them, minus 3, minus 1 constraint from the N, I, and the N equations of motion, leaving us with 2 degrees of freedom. Here, if we allow terms that violate time diffeomorphism invariants, the N is no longer a Lagrange multiplier, so its equation of motion just fixes N. Okay. The Ni are still Lagrange multipliers because of the residual diffeomorphism symmetry. So I have 6 minus 3 equals 3 physical degrees of freedom. And so this is just reminding you that like any local quote-unquote symmetry, diffeomorphisms are a fake. They're a redundancy of description. So the physical issue isn't, do you write the theory, the Lagrangian, in a way that does or doesn't look generally coordinate invariant? The question is, what the hell are the physical degrees of freedom? And once you write down a theory where it does not have manifest general coordinate invariance or any local symmetry, it's convenient to introduce explicitly the degrees of freedom that make it have that symmetry in order to study what the new degrees of freedom are. So it's the analog exactly what we do in gauge theory, and those degrees of freedom are the pi's for us. In this language, the original ghost condensation picture, so I could just in principle have started from the very beginning and told you, here is the theory, it only has these residual diffeomorphisms, I'm going to study what this extra degree of freedom does, and I'm going to do it just by making the time diffeomorphism and promoting that parameter to a field, like we always do. Somehow people are uncomfortable with that, I don't know why. So instead, this is a spontaneous symmetry breaking picture. So the ghost condensate here is the analog of talking about a linear signal model to generate gauge boson mass. So it's not necessary, but it is a useful way of thinking. Okay. Let me tell you what this Lagrangian looks like. In unitary gauge, at linearized level, it looks like this. There's a first term which just looks like H00 squared. That doesn't look too surprising, but it's actually very important that that's not the only term, and that there are other terms that look like this. They look like funny kinetic terms for the gravitons. And at fully nonlinear level, all these things get promoted. This thing looks like G00 minus 1. And all of these objects and the rest of them come from geometric objects that are diffeomorphism invariant under the residual diffeomorphisms, so functions of the extrinsic curvature, the intrinsic curvature, and so on. But you can do the standard power counting for the systematic derivative expansion and see that those are in fact the leading terms. All right, so much for the descriptive part of the talk. Let me now start trying to explain how some of these things happen. So let's talk about ghost condensation. So I've already said this. So the question is there any way we can, in analogy with tachyon condensation, imagine that there's higher order terms that stabilize things? Okay. So again, these are all higher dimensional, so really we should consider this whole thing, just general functions here. Again, naively, no sensible effective field theory. But there is one, and let's press on a little bit to see it. So I'm just going to begin with this term, the things that only depend on one derivative acting on phi. And for the moment, I'm going to ignore all the rest of the terms. The other ones are going to be very important in a second. But now let's just look at the equation of motion. It's very easy. There is the equation of motion. And clearly, a solution with d mu phi equals a constant is always a solution. Okay? And that's true for any derivatively coupled theory. Okay, and so let me assume it's time-like, and let me go to a frame then where it's homogeneous, so phi dot is equal to c, phi is equal to ct. Notice that now, unlike a tachyon, I actually have a solution here for any c. So I can sit there, I can sit anywhere here, and stay there. We can then just look at small fluctuations around there, stick that in the action, look at quadratic order, and now just demand that the coefficient of both the time and the space kinetic terms are normal, the right time kinetic terms. I can do that. There's some simple set of requirements. And in this picture, this entire region, starting from a minimum of this function out, is stable. Okay? All these things have the right time kinetic terms. This is P. I'm sorry. This is P. Yes. All the small fluctuations are stable. Now, in this language, you can sort of physically see why it's possible to have a good effective field theory. And the reason is that the background sits at a constant value of c. See, if I give you some random higher dimensional theory and constructed a random background, it would be flip-flopping all over the place in phi. And so the background itself depends infinitely on the details of what this function looks like. And even in small fluctuations around the background, we'll probe this function p everywhere, not here. Here it's sitting at a particular value of c, and the small fluctuations are only probing a small neighborhood of that point. So the global nature of the function is actually irrelevant. Okay? A small number of parameters can be used to construct the low energy effective theory. And said more formally, these backgrounds are characterized by a symmetry breaking pattern. Okay? They preserve the sort of maximal symmetry they can, breaking, for example, Lorentz invariants down to spatial rotations. Okay? The pi's have to nonlinearly realize the full symmetry of the theory. So as always in theories with symmetry breaking, the Goldstone bosons, the pi's, their Lagrangian is highly constrained by the requirement that they nonlinearly realize the full symmetries of the theory, in this case, the full Poincaré symmetry of the theory. Okay. So far, the possible backgrounds of this theory are labeled by this continuous parameter c, but now things start getting interesting because the situation changes in the presence of gravity. This is even true for a normal massless scalar field with a positive sign kinetic term. Without gravity, it can have any velocity. With gravity, we know what happens. It dilutes as the universe expands in the future. And in the deep future, you're left with Minkowski space and no velocity. Okay? But that doesn't happen here. So if I just minimally couple this to gravity and now look at the gravity equation of motion, and look at the scalar equation of motion, I find that here it is. So this combination has to be a constant. And in a universe that expands forever, that means that this combination, p prime times phi dot, must go to 0. Okay. There's two ways this can happen. Either phi dot goes to 0, or p prime goes to 0. Of course, phi dot equals 0 is our unstable, ghostly background. So this is the only thing that has a hope of being stable. So this sort of moduli space of possible solutions is lifted by gravity, by Hubble friction, and you get driven to this point. Gravity drives you here. Now, note, this background spontaneously breaks Lorentz invariants. There's a preferred frame in which phi is spatially isotropic, But this is no different than the way that any cosmological fluid, Blake's Lorentz invariance, like the CMBR or any other cosmological fluid. Okay? There's no philosophical problem with the existence or not of an ether. There is an ether in the universe, it's the CMBR. But what makes the ghost condensate special is that unlike other cosmological fluids, it does not dilute as the universe expands in the deep future. Okay? Normally, things expand, and by the time they get flat, it's empty. There's no more actual Lorentz violation in the background. Not here. Here, you have this phi dot is equal to constant even as the universe expands, and in fact, if we look at its energy-momentum tensor, it goes precisely to that of a cosmological constant. Okay? So even if lambda is equal to zero here, you can find a solution, which is the sitter, with the scalar rocketing along. You could have a combination of a cosmological constant in this, for example. So I can have something which is just sitting there and flat with the scalar rocketing along. So you could attribute the present acceleration to this or not. I mean, I'm personally not a huge fan of saying you have an alternative of driving the acceleration of the universe because we don't understand the cosmological constant problem. So, but anyway, it is interesting that there's another kind of fluid, another physical way you can realize a de Sitter phase of the universe. And it's different than a cosmological constant. It's a physical fluid. It has physical excitations. Let's go back and look at the small perturbations, because you may not remember, but I told you that things were stable in this region, but were being driven right to the point, which is at the borderline between stability and instability. And you can actually see that, because right at this point, with just the terms p, there is a time, but no spatial kinetic term for pi. All these higher order terms do contain spatial derivatives for pi. However, they start at least at order grad squared pi squared. So that means the low energy Lagrangian must have this form, and the dispersion relation must be k to the fourth. Okay. Now, so I've told you what the quadratic terms are in the effective theory. Of course, there's many other terms in the effective theory. Here is the next leading one. There's pi dot grad pi grad pi. And in order to convince you that this theory doesn't suffer from the problems of the older theories, I have to convince you that this is a healthy sector in the absence of gravity. Okay? If you have a healthy sector in the absence of gravity, if you weakly couple it to gravity, you're not going to have terrible disasters. Beforehand, we had a situation where even at quadratic level, there are no kinetic terms. Okay? Here we have kinetic terms. We're doing better already, but we're not done, because the quadratic kinetic term we have is higher order than we're used to. It's k to the fourth and not k squared. And what that means is, because it's k to the fourth, the spatial fluctuations of pi are less suppressed than they are in a relativistic field theory. So to analyze a low energy theory, we have to do something that, as relativistic effective field theorists, we're not used to doing. In relativistic effective field theory, scaling dimensions and mass dimensions are the same. But those of us who learned effective field theory from Joe, or from Joe's papers, know that in non-relativistic theories, the situation is different. And so you have to figure out what the scaling dimensions are by, if you're talking about a low energy effective theory, you have to ask what happens as you scale energies. And so clearly, so I have to scale times. If I scale energy by a factor of r, I have to scale times by an r inverse. K has to clearly scale like the square root of that, because the omega is like k squared. And that gives pi a very peculiar scaling dimension of a quarter. Okay. But now I have the scaling dimension of all the fields. I can now look at the leading interaction, calculate its dimension, and I find that its dimension is, 4 plus, its scaling dimension is minus a quarter. It's barely irrelevant. So we got through by the skin of our teeth. Okay? Had this been a relevant operator, this would not be a decent effective theory. It would break down at low energies. Okay? The leading interaction is irrelevant, even though it's sort of, you know, numerically, marginally, irrelevant. That's going to be interesting later. But anyway, there is a good low energy effective theory here. And had it been k to the sixth, we would have been cooked. Okay. But this should now convince you that this is a healthy sector, even in the absence of gravity. I now couple gravity to it and see what gravity does. All right. Now let me just show you the Well, so we talked about this already, but if I just look at the energies of this theory, this is what a particle physicist would call the energy. But as I said before, it's not the energy that gravitates. The energy momentum tensor, when you just expand it out, has a pi dot piece, and so we have this picture from before, where pi has the interesting features of an unusual dispersion relation in gravity and anti-gravity. All right, so I can talk about the systematic construction of the low energy effective field theory and just show you in more detail how this works, but just in the interest of time, let me not do that. Let me just say that, okay, as I said, there's a systematic 3+1 split. You can just do it. Okay, it's, there's no particular interest in that. But if you want to see what the unitary gauge effective Lagrangian looks like, there it is. Okay, there's terms that are diffeomorphism invariant. Oh, I'm sorry. There's terms that are fully diffeomorphism invariant, of course, and then here are the leading terms. There's actually three terms, which are the leading terms in the low energy effective field theory, proportional to things that have to do with G00 minus 1 squared and the extrinsic curvature. Actually, there's also something that's proportional to the intrinsic three-dimensional curvature, but r plus k squared minus the trace of k squared is just the four-dimensional r, so I can trade that for that combination. Ah, so in this formulation, the way you would see what the pi effect of Lagrangian is to now do the broken diffeomorphisms and identify the time diffeomorphism with the pi fields, and then turn off gravity. Okay, so as I mentioned before, we get these interesting particle anti-particle mass splittings and long-range forces potentially. But let me talk about the model independent effects that are the effects of gravity mixing with the condensate. Since we just have one new scalar degree of freedom, I can just go to longitudinal gauge and I just keep the scalar parts of gravity. So there's the metric. Here's just at quadratic order what the Lagrangian looks like. Okay. And if I canonically normalize all the fields, I have a Lagrangian where pi mixes with phi now. Okay, phi is the gravitational potential. And there's the kinetic term for pi with its k to the fourth dispersion relation. There's the k squared term for phi. And then there's a weak coupling between them, the 1 over m Planck suppressed, which are these terms. Okay. So just a trivial little 2x2 matrix, which we can diagonalize. And here's what we find. The first thing we find is that the dispersion relation for pi is modified. Oh, this is all in flat space, I'm sorry. The dispersion relation is modified, that's what it was before, and it gets something that's proportional to k squared, and Planck suppressed a negative. So there's an instability at large length scales, small k. You shouldn't be too scared of that, because that's exactly the analog of the Jeans instability for this fluid. Gravity is unstable at large distances. Ordinarily, there's just something that's a negative omega g squared, and you have a normal fluid. Here, it's a k to the fourth fluid, and there's an extra k squared there. Okay? And as confirmation of the fact that this is just a normal Jeans instability, you can check that if you perform the same calculation now in an expanding universe, or for simplicity in a de Sitter background, where the Hubble rate is large compared to the Jeans instability timescale, that the instability goes away. Okay? In exactly the same way as it does for ordinary stuff. So that's just the Jeans instability of this fluid. And then you can diagonalize the other one and you get this wiggly behavior that I talked about before. And again, physically it's wiggly because of the anti-gravity of pi, and it's the opposite sign because of the usual reason signs are opposite for gravity in the H theory. Okay, thank you. Great, so summarizing, the Gauss condensate is a new kind of fluid that can fill the universe. As I said, we don't have to talk about it in Gauss condensation language. Sort of specifically, you see, all that matters is what's going on near the bottom of these functions. So to call it a Gauss condensate, you know, I'm just drawing the simplest picture where I start at the top and I go down. Of course, you could have something much more complicated and end up going down. It doesn't really care what's happening at the origin, just as probing locally what's happening out here. But the sort of simplest picture for it is to imagine that it's coming from Gauss condensation. It's a new kind of fluid that fills the universe. It doesn't dilute as the universe expands, like a cosmological constant, but it's not a cosmological constant. Physical fluid, real scalar excitation. Direct coupling of the standard model to the sector gives interesting phenomenon, tiny particle antiparticle mass splittings, spin-dependent 1 over r squared forces. And we get modifications of gravity, anti-gravity, oscillatory forces, and changes at unexpected length and time scales. Now let me mention a couple of applications of this idea. The first one we've talked about already, this could just be an alternate origin for, so It could just be an alternate origin for the de Sitter phases of the universe. It could be the acceleration of the universe today. And cosmological observations cannot distinguish this from the cosmological constant. W equals minus one, exactly. This is not quintessence. It's not something that's basically a cosmological constant. Okay? It looks identical to a cosmological constant to cosmological experiments. The only way you could tell is A, if you waited a really, 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 really long time and started seeing oscillatory Newtonian potentials, or B, if you were lucky enough to couple to the sector directly and saw tiny particle antiparticle mass splittings and Lagrange inverse square law forces. Spin dependent. Sorry? The field has fluctuations? Yes. Yes. Only if you couple to it. So it does. Its fluctuations today are minuscule. I'm going to talk about fluctuations in a second, though. Another interesting point. I've told you that you get driven down to this point by Hubble friction, and if this field was sort of rolling early on in the history of the universe, you really get nailed down to that point really, really quickly. Okay, way before recently, in the already by TeV temperatures, you're here. But if for some reason this only started happening recently, then it's easy to check that the energy density stored in that field, before it looks like a cosmological constant, actually redshifts exactly like non-relativistic matter. Okay. So this has the potential to give you both dark matter and dark energy at the same time. There's a huge caveat here, which is that I have no idea if this clumps properly. Okay, I have no idea if it does the things that dark matter is supposed to do for structure formation, and I'm looking. But as far as just the evolution of the scale factor goes, it's possible to go from a stage where it looks like dark matter domination to a de Sitter phase. Okay. But another application is to a qualitatively different picture of the inflationary de Sitter phase of the universe. Okay? So imagine now, like an inflation, that this field has a potential. Remember I told you it needed to have a shift symmetry. Of course, I have to imagine that somehow the shift symmetry is broken in some region of phi. So way out here, there's a good shift symmetry. Way out here, there's a good shift symmetry. For some reason that I'm not even going to talk about, because I haven't thought about it, the shift symmetry is broken over some range of phi. But it's certainly perfectly technically natural out here, and perfectly technically natural out there. Okay. This gives me a de Sitter phase, but it's other than the fact that it's de Sitter, it's completely different than standard inflation, because this is not slow roll. Okay. Yes, 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 absolutely. Sorry? Yes, yes, absolutely. If you think about it, yes. But let me tell you the story. So you still get a scale invariant spectrum of perturbation. The scale invariance is just a consequence of the fact that it's de Sitter. But the size is completely different. For example, delta rho over rho, it's still the same formula, h delta pi over pi dot. But here are the differences. Not slow roll. Pi dot is m squared. Okay. Also, the fluctuations of delta pi are different than h. Remember, pi had this funny scaling dimension of a quarter. So it's, in fact, this formula. Okay. So the final formula for delta rho over rho is h over m to the 5/4. Compare with h over m Planck root epsilon. There's no m Planck here. You could have much, much, much lower scale of inflation without a problem. But to me, more interestingly, okay, well, so what? I mean, if we just see Gaussian perturbations, we can't distinguish. But there is a real prediction here, which is that this theory really predicts large and visible non-Gaussianities. And if we look at this leading order nonlinear interaction, this gives us much bigger non-Gaussianities, but allowed, than you get from inflation. Basically because, remember, this operator was just barely irrelevant. Okay? So the size of non-Gaussianities you get from this is h over m to the quarter. That is parametrically delta rho over rho to the fifth. And so parametrically, it's actually 10%. That's too big. But when you really, really do it properly, as Juan found when he did it properly for standard inflation, when you do these things properly, the pi's always hurt you. Okay. In this case, the pi's hurt you to help you get this down to the level of 10^-2. Thanks, I'm almost done. And again, this is to be contrasted with standard inflation, where the size of the non-Gaussianities is parametrically of the same size as delta rho over rho itself. It's 10^-5. And furthermore, because there's one operator, and this is the leading operator, there's no other operator, all the other operators have higher dimensions, you have a very specific prediction for what the three-point function should look like. Okay? So You lay down a triangle in the sky. It's a three-point function, so three k's that have to add up to zero. You lay down a triangle in the sky, and the three-point fluctuation for the perturbations is then just predicted up to an overall amplitude. But the actual dependence, I can parameterize the triangle by one and two sides. It's just predicted, and this is what it looks like. That region is where the triangle is equilateral. Now, amusingly, people have put limits on what the non-Gaussianity looks like, but what their k-dependence looks like in these analyses, it actually looks like that. So it's exactly the opposite of this sort of k-dependence. No one has done the analysis for this k-dependence, so I don't know what the limit is. But if you see non-Gaussianity, this is a hard prediction for this theory. All right. So I'm done. I just want to make one more comment.
If you drive inflation with it.
If you drive inflation with it. Yes, yes, I'm sorry. But you really can't screw it up because there's just no other operators. The next one is of dimension a half, and this is really the leading effect. I just want to make one more comment, which is that I've phrased it in the language of Gauss condensation, but another, and this is sort of very speculative, but another way of motivating why such a theory might be relevant to nature is that we know that one of the sort of conceptual problems in putting quantum mechanics and gravity together is that quantum mechanics needs time, and gravity allows you to flip things around. So now, obviously, at some level, this problem is solved. Okay, but if somehow there's a small mismatch, and there is a sense in which we can talk about a preferred time direction, even a little bit, this is the theory that describes what the physics is at low energies. Okay, so that's another possible way this might arise. So I'm just going to end. There's obviously many open questions. I've barely talked about phenomenology. I haven't thought very much about the phenomenology, and I don't know what the exact current limits are on this theory, on basically any aspects of it, other than very gross things, because the features are just so unusual. I mean, people haven't talked about modifications of gravity, which are little blips around 1,000 kilometers. Okay. This question of can pi be dark matter and dark energy simultaneously? What happens with nonlinear effects in black holes? No idea. And finally, the fact that it's possible to have a particle physics and gravitational energy that aren't the same smells good for the cosmological constant problem. Although, of course, the problem is it's for this crazy sector and not for us. Okay? But is there any way in which we can use this as a little in on the CC problem? That's something else I'd like to think about. Thanks a lot. Sorry for going over time.
Any questions?
What's the behavior of this kind of theory under radiative corrections?
It's a stable quantum effective theory. And it's constructed as such. Now, there's something interesting about it, which is that you can ask, if someone just handed you that Lagrangian, you know, pi dot squared minus grad squared pi, you'd say there's a relevant operator in this theory, grad pi squared, right? Just the k squared kinetic term. Why don't you generate that? And if I just handed you that theory in flat space, absolutely you would generate that, okay? It's because, remember, without gravity, there's no reason to sit here. We could have sat anywhere, okay? But the interesting thing is that the universe is driving you to this point by Hubble friction. So in the language of this effective theory, the universe is fine-tuning away the coefficient of one relevant operator, which is the grad pi squared. Okay? So if I just took that effective theory and did radiative corrections, bam, I have the grad pi squared. But then it back reacts on gravity, the universe expands, and you get driven to the point where that operator is gone.
It looks to me that the question of Lorentz violation and so on is tied up with the fact of whether you assume that d mu phi has an expectation value or d mu phi as a bilinear.
Yes, yes.
Because if d mu phi is proportional to g mu nu.
That's impossible because d mu phi is rank 1 right. And eta mu nu has rank 4. Okay. So it's impossible to have a phi such that d mu phi is equal to eta mu nu. Now, having said that, the relationship with these other, let me explain to you the relationship with massive gravity. Okay, massive gravity, ordinary Pauli-Firch Lorentz invariant massive gravity, is a theory of four scalar fields, phi sub a, which have an internal Lorentz symmetry acting on them. Okay, and it's a theory where d nu phi a, d nu phi b, eta a b is equal to eta mu nu. Okay, so it's a theory where phi 0 is equal to t, phi 1 is equal to x, and so on. Okay? Okay? That theory ends up being Pauli Fiert's massive gravity. However, it turns out that this requirement is so strong that when you study the theory, as I did with Schwartz and Georgia, that in fact there's no kinetic term for the scalar longitudinal mode, and it's a sick sector in the absence of gravity. Because of the coupling with gravity, this field picks up a kinetic term, but it's small, okay? And that's the origin of all the weird things about massive gravity, from the famous VDVZ discontinuity to everything else. Okay? So our theory is a sort of simplified version where we throw away the rest of the structure, and we just keep,
More questions?
Yeah, I guess I wanted to just draw out a little bit your open issue number 3 about nonlinear things.
Right.
The point being, I wanted to emphasize that it's interesting to ask that question not just at the bottom of your potential with the ghosts of condensed, but also on the top where you have real negative energies that are of less controlled form.
Yeah.
There's all kinds of potential things that one might call further instabilities, like violations of the second law for black holes.
So
time machines. Wormholes.
Yeah. What I can say about that, and again, this is why calling it ghost condensation isn't as honest as tachyon condensation, because in tachyon condensation, at least I can tell a story of how you get from the top to the bottom. Okay. Here, all I can say is that up here the theory's is unstable. Down here is a nice, healthy place for it, okay? But the difference is that when you have the ghosts, the instability is dominated by short-distance physics, okay? And so I can't tell a story where I make a bubble here, and I can't tell a story fully within a consistent effective theory. But it would be, I mean, if there's any way in which one could embed this into a UV-complete theory. The sort of way I could imagine this could come out of string theory is that there are models which you might just have thrown out because they have negative norm states, but perhaps they can make sense if you condense the fields that those negative norm states belong to. Maybe, first you'd have to find an example like that, and then maybe in an example like that you could follow the evolution from here to here. If you could do that, I think there's a whole world of really interesting phenomenon. For example, that would allow you to start in flat space and end in De Sitter space. Okay? And if you could do that, I would bet you that there are alternative ways of solving the horizon and the flatness problems by waiting.
The microphone is working its way around the room.
I would have thought that the stress tensor, which couples to gravity, should include this background condensate as well as the fluctuating field.
Right.
Okay, so then it's not clear to me why, if the stress tensor is conserved, why the condensate doesn't dilute.
So it's sort of what always happens when you have spontaneous symmetry breaking. All the currents are always conserved. Okay, it's just that when you have spontaneous symmetry breaking, the d mu j mu equals zero equation turns into the equation of motion for the Goldstone bosons. And so actually t mu nu is conserved. I'm not saying t mu nu isn't conserved. It is conserved. But there's another energy, which is the particle physics energy, which at least, which is fine and is quadratic. And I think your question is, why did t mu nu not include a one term? And it can. I just, in that example, I was fine-tuning the cosmological constant, the overall. I was fine-tuning to get flat space. Okay? If I don't fine-tune to get flat space, then I would get this theory in a De Sitter background.
Okay, more questions? Parody is violated. They're all over the here.
Okay, just a remark that this ghost condensate mechanism for inflation is exactly what we discussed a few years ago with Slava Muranov under the name of K-inflation, which has been then further extended by Slava Muranov and Steinhardt in the case of dark energy. But the original idea was to get just this De Sitter
condensate. So let me say, I haven't looked at all of the K-inflation literature. I haven't looked at all the K-inflation literature, but from what I saw, K-inflation people do not like to go to the minimum. K-inflation people like to stay away from this, from the point I like, precisely because only there do they have, because they only study, they think it's an instability, but that's because they're not adding all the terms in the effective theory, including the box phi terms and so on. That is the, so. Yeah. Oh, we're not breaking gauge invariants either. Oh, we're not breaking coordinate invariants either. There's no such thing as coordinate invariants. No, I mean, no, there isn't. But let me say, so it's true for any scalar field, any background with any rolling scalar field, I can always go to a gauge where phi equals t. That's not special about this. What's special about it, and what makes this different than a standard scalar field, is that if I take a standard scalar field or inflation or something and I go to phi equals t gauge, the metric isn't flat, or it isn't de Sitter. It isn't maximally symmetric. Here, by the time you go to phi equals t gauge, you have maximal symmetry, flat space or de Sitter space. Physically, this is a statement that this fluid does not dilute as the universe expands.
So your fundamental theory, if we go all invariant,
yes, absolutely.
You say that your solution is
just absolutely, absolutely.
More question?
So I'm trying to think about cosmology with this, and I guess you partly already said you can't tell the whole story as this rolls down.
Well, I'm not. I don't necessarily even have to imagine starting here. I could imagine that I started around.
But I guess I'm trying to. So one thing you said is it could look like a pressureless fluid for a little bit.
Pressureless fluid.
Didn't you say it could be dark matter?
Oh, I'm sorry. Yes. If it's rolling from here to here.
But then that's also a delicate thing. It could be giving you a monopole problem. I mean, exactly what?
Oh, no. If all the scales here are a millimeter, which is the case I was thinking of, it has the right magnitude of the energy density to be dark matter.
So
it doesn't give
do you have a
problem.
Concept of where it starts and why it starts there or that kind of thing?
Okay. So that has to do with, how close you get there has to do with the ratio of the scale factors of when it started rolling to today cubed. Okay? So if we imagine somehow that this whole physics is associated with some late phase transition recently in the history of the universe, then I'd expect that it starts somewhere around here and is rolling down. And this is fully within control of the effective theory, I should say. That's not like starting from here. This is something that's fully controllable and calculable. We just haven't done it. Okay, I would be surprised if it works because, this is a funny fluid. I don't see why it should clump properly. But if it does clump properly, I think that would be very, very exciting.
Okay, two more quick questions, then we go get coffee.
So the effective value of the cosmological constant, that was determined by one of the parameters in the Lagrangian?
Yeah, and a cosmological constant as well. So
because if this is a fluid, if it's a fluid that's doing it, you would think that the density of particles in the fluid should control
right.
that.
Right, and if you like, phi dot is the density, right? You know, if phi star dt phi is the number density.
Okay, one more question.
So it seems to me if you don't use this field as the inflaton, that there's a potential problem here of big inhomogeneities in cosmology because the level surfaces of this field and of the inflaton won't be the same, naturally.
Level surfaces of the inflaton? Oh, because of the k to the fourth dispersion relation, that's not true. If you didn't have that term, it would be true. But with the k to the fourth, just for the sort of standard reason, gradient terms dilute. So if you imagine starting off in a path, you know, you have to have the usual kind of things that go into. I agree. If you start with some order one difference, you're screwed. But if you're sort of close enough, then inflation does its thing and dilutes gradients.
I see. Okay.
So, but it's very important to have these the k to the fourth. It's important to have the spatial kinetic terms. Yeah.
I see. Thank you.
Okay, we'll reconvene at 4:10. Let's thank Nima again.